I am Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Laura Moriarty teaches creative writing at the University of Kansas, and she's known in the literary world for her novels, The Center of Everything, The Rest of Her Life, While I'm Falling, and her 2012 novel, The Chaperone, in which she reimagines the life of silent film star Louise Brooks. Her latest novel, Sunlight Finds You, is her first without a Kansas connection. Spanning from the 1940s to the 1960s in St. Petersburg, Florida, the book follows Nora, a young woman who falls in love with her schoolmate Leonard, and the pair find themselves in an entanglement that spans decades and creates a web of secrets.
I set out to write a big love story, not exactly a romance, but a story about how a deeply felt love can change a person and altered the course of her life. I set it in the late 1940s, which I think was such an interesting time period of optimism, but it was also a complicated time, especially for women. So it's 1947 when Nora's family moves to St. Petersburg, Florida. On the first day of high school, she meets Leonard. He is a few years ahead of her in school, and he's from a wealthy family. But they form a connection that is intellectual as well as physical. And the emotions are so strong that within a few years, they're engaged. However, plans change. She finds herself not just heartbroken and alone, but pregnant. And being unmarried and pregnant was, of course, an especially humiliating and isolating circumstance in this era. And for Nora, that shame is compounded by secrecy and betrayal. She spends years questioning everything, including who she is and who Leonard really was and why she can't forget him.
Nora has just moved from Rolla, Missouri to St. Petersburg, Florida. Set up her situation for us. What should we know about her? You know, she had some stuff happen with her family back in Missouri, right?
Right. She has sort of become almost superstitious about lying. And this is just all in the first chapter. You know, she tells a lie in childhood and her mother dies not long after. And her child mind links those two things together. So even later when she, you know, becomes an adolescent and thinking critically, she knows that the lie didn't cause the mother's death. But because of her, you know, you get sort of paranoid that you're not going to be able to do something. And to lie convincingly, you have to really go in smoothly. And she has that second delay. So she's a terrible liar. She knows that about herself. She can't lie about anything convincingly, which leads to, you know, problems. But that's sort of her Achilles heel at the beginning. But, you know, other than that, she's confident. She's exuberant, you know, when she finds out the family is moving to Florida. She goes. She loves her family. She falls in love with Florida first, with the nature. She's very open-hearted and ready to take on everything coming at her, I would say. And also her family is working class, which I just liked them as being working class, and that ended up being part of the plot. You know, they're sort of upwardly striving at a time. And so they're also coming to Florida to seek opportunity.
Where did this story begin for you? I'm curious about where your initial idea came from and how you brought it to life.
The story isn't about my mom, you know, but she and I talked a lot about what it was like to grow up in this era. And I mean, she always loved Florida and missed Florida, you know, and spoke about it with such longing in this era, with such longing. Parts of it, right? Parts of it, like, oh, you know, you could reach up and pick an orange. It was so wonderful. But she also, you know, talked about how hard it was and how different it was for women. And they had limited opportunities legally and socially. You know, also it was a Jim Crow state at the time. Like, it wasn't paradise for everyone. And so those conversations with her, and then also reading what other women of that generation wrote about what it was like to come of age in that era, really got me thinking about how women and girls had to navigate this narrow path, even if they had the same desires and dreams of self-determination we have now. So that's where it started. I moved it to St. Pete and not Orlando. I know Orlando better because I would go down there, you know, to visit our extended family down there. And I like so much about Orlando, but I wanted it to be on the water. You know, I really wanted that. And then also I found out that, you know, St. Petersburg has such a fascinating history at this time, because at the beginning of the 40s, it was just a town. It was like the size of the town that I live in now in Kansas, Lawrence, around 100,000 people. So I kind of had a sense of like how frequently you could or couldn't bump into someone, you know, because I know that town size. But by the end of the 40s, it had doubled in size. And that's because during World War II, so many soldiers moved through it on their way overseas, and they saw how lovely it was. And so at the end of the war, a lot of them moved there and they brought their families. And then, you know, they figured out how to make air conditioning more affordable. So it was just this boom town, right? This little beautiful seaside town turned boom town. And so I think whenever you have people coming in from all over and swelling a population, it leads to really interesting interactions with class and values. And so I kind of had my place, I had my time, I knew it was a love story, and then I just started going forward.
You know, I want to touch on something you just mentioned, and it was something I wasn't aware of until I read your book, and that is the employment laws for married women. Can you explain those a little bit?
Yeah, they were marriage laws. The idea was that if you were married, that you didn't need the income, you know, and you should be home with your family or you should be keeping house. But I think the idea was also to protect jobs for those who needed them, meaning men or women who weren't yet married or who were widowed or, you know, I guess even divorced. But if you were married, so you would lose your job, even doing these jobs that we think of as, you know, that were acceptable at that time for women or were more routine, like, you know, teacher and nurse. Once you got married, that was it. And it varied from state to state, but yeah.
You know, I know the title contains the word sunlight, and there seemed to be a lot of sun and shade and such throughout the novel. Or maybe I was just imagining it, but I underlined it every time I saw it. What did you want to explore with this theme of light and sunlight?
Well, you know, I pay attention to light a lot, and I also notice it a lot when I'm reading, but there's nothing that I'm doing consciously, right? And so it's always very interesting when other people find patterns, because I'm not doing it on purpose. But, you know, I know that someone once asked me, like, after my third novel, they had figured out all these ways that I talk about cars, and they're like, I noticed this deep distrust of the automobile. And they made a great case for it with three or four of my novels. And I thought, oh my gosh, I never, never noticed that. But they're absolutely right. I do distrust. You know, I have this thing about wanting to be close enough that I can walk. I love the freedom of a car, but I don't trust them to not break down or have something terrible happen. And so I think it's funny with sunlight, I didn't purposely put anything in. But I do love the title, you know, it's from the song, Dream a Little Dream of Me, Sweet Dreams Till Sunbeams Find You. And this idea that, you know, it's hopeful. It's hopeful about something finding you and coming through darkness. And so that title did seem right at the end.
I want to go back and talk about Nora's inability to tell a lie. And she was really focused on truth throughout this novel. But there were so many people in her orbit who feels like all they did was lie. Can you talk a little bit about what you wanted to explore with truth and lies with these other characters?
Yeah, you know, I think when you're someone like Nora who has so much trouble lying, like she can do it, right? Like everyone needs to lie sometimes. And she can sort of rally for a while and sometimes do it. But she's just not good at it. And I think when you're coming from that framework, you sort of subconsciously think that other people have the same problem lying, right? It's like, oh, well, then they couldn't do it either, right? And it takes her a while to understand she has to learn the hard way that some people can look right at you and lie and lie and lie and do so so convincingly. And so she does have to learn that the hard way. And, you know, even the people who do lie to her, I mean, I think of the two great liars in the book, the great manipulators. And one of them, you know, has my compassion. I don't know if all readers will feel that way, but I do feel compassion for one liar. And the other one, boy, is just icy cold. And she's surprised by both. She's taken aback by both and really beats herself up for it. But I also think it's kind of a credit to her that I think her trust and her naivete come from her very honest self, who she is. But of course, the plot demands, or, you know, the pregnancy in the situation demands so much lying from her. And that's the terrible situation she's put in. I did so much sad research on the maternity homes of this era and what happened to unmarried girls and women, including women who were in their 30s, you know, and older. If you had an unmarried pregnancy, you were going to start having to lie to everyone you knew about and make up these unbelievable, like awful, you know, and kind of know that no one believed you and had to stick to the story. Millions of women this happened to, millions of girls and women. And so, yeah, lying and honesty really become major points of contention throughout the novel.
I underlined this quote from early in the book. People in charge can always find ways to justify bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And although this was set in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, it feels like it could refer to 2025, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, it's funny. I have Leonard's mother say that early on, and she's talking about segregation because it is. It's a segregated state. You know, you think even like a tourist paradise, allegedly, you know, paradise in air quotes, like St. Pete in the 40s, it was still in Florida, you know, and Florida was having lynchings, like it was the South. And maybe along the coast, from what I understand of reading African-American oral histories, you know, it was better than in the interior, and certainly better along the coast than, you know, in Georgia and Mississippi, but it was still segregated. And so Nora, coming from Missouri, another segregation state, it's just business as usual to her. You know, she doesn't think anything of it. It's the water in which she's always swum. But Leonard's family, they're far more cosmopolitan. They're New Yorkers. They're aghast by this, right? They're just like, oh, this is so backward. This is so strange. And so she's trying to sort of enlighten Nora. She's this much more sophisticated character. And she's telling Nora, you know, the French, they look at us with horror that we have this segregation in so much of our country. And yeah, the bad will always justify their behavior. And then that plays out in the book so much as people find these ways to justify their terrible, terrible behavior, especially to Nora. And so, yeah, and then I think that that is just a French expression that has so much truth in general. Yeah.
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Laura Moriarty, author of the novel Sunlight Finds You. I always notice when books are mentioned in books. Nora notices Leonard's mother reading a copy of The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. And it's a surprising pick for its, you know, depiction of liberated women. What does this book come to mean to Nora?
Yeah, I have this scene early on. So she sees, as you say, she sees Leonard's mother reading this book. And she has Leonard's mother, you know, is someone she admires so much for her sophistication and elegance. You know, she finds out that she was an understudy for Katharine Hepburn at Bryn Mawr. And for someone like Nora, who's, you know, working class from this little town in Missouri, it's like she's just never experienced anyone like this. So she sees this novel and she thinks, okay, I want to do that. And then she goes to the library to try to get it. And she gets scolded, right, for wanting such a vulgar book at her age, which, of course, a librarian wouldn't do now, but would have done then, you know? And so that makes her want to read it more, and eventually she does. But she finds that novel, she has her own take on it, right? Like what she thinks about it and what she notices. And of course, then she makes a friend later who is also pretty sophisticated and has an interesting read on that. I mean, I find that book really interesting because there is, you know, a lot of Hemingway bashing now in especially feminist circles. And I will say, having read, oh, what was that wonderful book that came out about the writing? There was this great book. Oh, it's a nonfiction book about the summer that he was in Spain getting ready to write The Sun Also Rises. And by the end of that book, I thought, boy, he was just an awful, awful person, just like a horrible person. But his writing, you know, it's beautiful. And I will say, The Sun Also Rises, with the character of Lady Brett, she's interesting. She's a really interesting full-fledged character. And Nora, in her youth, notices that this character, conceived of by a man, is sexually liberated and makes decisions that she wants to make for her own agency. And, you know, Nora sort of puts together that this is what they didn't want her reading. And so she's smart enough to put all that together in little ways. Like, it doesn't all happen at once. And I think that's what she gets out of so many novels that she reads, because in so many ways, she has sort of a provincial life. Like, even after she moves to Florida, it's not like she's, you know, going to travel a whole lot. And she's not exposed to new ideas frequently, except through her own reading, which I think she realizes is sort of her ticket to a larger world.
Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women was also mentioned. And the irony here is that it's a text about women's empowerment while this individual is pressuring her and essentially stripping Nora of her power. What did you want to explore here with the inclusion of this text?
That people can use anything to twist. I mean, it's ironic that Hemingway is the empowering one and Wollstonecraft is the one used to trick her. That it can be, you know, people can use words to do all kinds of things. You know, the first book reference, I think, is Orwell, right? So,
right.
Yeah, it is. It's so sad the way that it's used. I think the person who does that is just such a master manipulator.
I have a whole list of books and authors and texts that were mentioned in your novel, from C.S. Lewis to Animal Farm to Jane Eyre to Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Now, we know these books had a special meaning for Nora. Do they hold a special meaning for you?
They do. I mean, they were all books, but there's so many books, right? If you're a reader, that you're like, oh, you know, this book did that for me. This book did that for me. I wanted to be really mindful, though, as I wrote, that the reader wouldn't feel cut off if they hadn't read these books. Like, I wanted to just do just enough where they would understand what I was getting at and not feel left out or even irritated. You know how you're reading along and then somebody starts referencing something that you're not familiar with? And so I really tried to put in just enough where you would understand what she was getting out of it. But certainly, even if you haven't read these books, if you're reading this novel, you read, and you must know, you know, the experience of reading something and having it just sort of open a little crack of either solace or opening something. You know, I love that image. It went around for a while as a meme of like a brick wall, and it had just like one book in it that slowly over time starts to bring down the wall. So many of my novels are about a character sort of slowly thinking her way out of the cultural messages of the moment. And it's so hard to do that, right? Like, I think I struggle with it now. And reading seems one of the big, big ways to do that. So that's what I was getting at. But with every novel I mentioned, like, I would get to a point, I didn't want to just say, oh, she reads. It's like, well, what is she reading? And I would have to stop and think and kind of go through my Rolodex of books and think, what book might find her right now? What book might connect her right now?
It felt like I noticed that there was some attention paid to Brahms. Am I imagining that, or did you want to explore something with his life and his music?
In my life, I've had these formative friendships with women who have broadened my horizons because they just know about so many things that I don't know about. I remember in college, you know, I had just arrived to Lawrence, Kansas from Bozeman, Montana, and I still had my perm, you know, and I only knew like what was playing on pop country music, you know, and wearing my acid wash jeans, feeling pretty cool. And I met this woman. She was so glamorous in the dorm that I just couldn't believe that I was even like living anywhere around her. You know, she'd been to France and Japan and she knew about opera. You know, her parents gave her like a restaurant allowance, you know, and a CD allowance. And I made friends with her because she hated peeling oranges. And so she said one day, like, who will peel this orange for me? I'll give them a dollar. And I was like, I will. And so every day I would peel her orange. And we ended up being kind of friends for a while, but she introduced me to all this music and art that I didn't know anything about. And it shaped me, you know, it absolutely shaped me and my tastes and opened up new worlds for me and resonated with my own life in ways that I kind of was hungry for. And so I think when this friend starts talking with her about Brahms, it's a little bit like that, right? Like, because Brahms was such an interesting character. I had no idea. There's a wonderful book about someone who knew him when she was young and, you know, his very complicated life. And then he writes that beautiful, beautiful statement of hope to his friend who's in mourning. And it's just such a beautiful quote. And so I think I was thinking of a way to sort of send that message in a bottle to Nora in a way that would be true and believable to the characters, but also like I wanted to send her that message of hope from Brahms because she really needed to hear it at that moment.
So you are still in Lawrence, Kansas. You teach creative writing at KU, is that right?
That's right.
Do you think your teaching affects your writing?
Ah, well, it slows it down. I mean, that's the trade-off, right? Like, it does. It really, and it's, I don't want to lie, like, it's frustrating because there's always an email. There's always, you know, something, will you read this? Will you read that? Will you do this? Will you go to this committee meeting? Will you, you know, and then you just kind of keep pushing it. And it is kind of terrible in that way, right? The good news is that I would say, you know, and then it is hard also because honestly, I do work with a lot of students who are not engaging with me. They're just, maybe they're engaging with each other. And so even that I'll take, right? But like, I would say maybe like an eighth of them are truly engaging with me. But of that eighth, it's really interesting. You know what I mean? Because they'll say things or they'll have a certain way of reading a text that I hadn't thought of. Also, like when some of them, even if they're not engaging with me, like about literature or writing, they'll come in and they'll sort of talk about what's going on with them. And it really keeps you in touch with what it feels like to be young and so unsure and how people might look one way from the outside. But once you get to know them, you know, it's a lot harder. Also, I have been introduced to a much wider array of people than I would have if left to my own devices. You know, Lawrence is a pretty white town, but KU, especially like the graduate program, you know, it's much more diverse and we have students coming in from all over the world and from all over the country. And so, you know, I meet people I never would have met otherwise and their perspectives have expanded my horizon in that way. And so I was like, oh, what would have happened if I would have just kept writing full time? I would have written more things and I would have written different things. So that's where I am. I do learn. I do learn from it. In the graduate students, you know, the ones that I connect with, you know, they can just be so brilliant and perceptive. And I can learn a lot with the ones who are more open to that kind of conversation.
Is there a piece of advice you would offer to students that you would also pass on to our listeners?
Well, they're the obvious things, like you have to read, right? You have to be a reader. But this is sort of even bigger than writing. What I have really noticed as a writing instructor and in my own work, that really what separates people who have talent but don't quite go anywhere to people who actually see something through that can work is they are able to re-see their original plans. You know, you can't take advice from everybody in a workshop, because sometimes that advice is wrong, right? Like sometimes they're not understanding what you're doing, or their own stuff is getting in the way. Just like in real life, when people give you advice about what you should do, you've got to ignore a lot of it, because some of it's bad advice or it's just not applicable to you. But I do think that most people, when they're getting feedback on work, they don't really hear it, or they think, oh, how can I make this advice fit in with my original vision? And they're still too rigid to really open up to re-seeing the piece. And I notice with my own work is when I've re-seen it, like, oh, I could tell the story like this. Oh, I could stop hanging on to that idea. So like, for example, with this book, I was absolutely convinced that it needed to be in third person, in multiple points of view, and that it needed to start when they were all children in St. Petersburg, right? Like there were pages and pages of Nora at 12 and Leonard being kids. And I was convinced, right? And it was only like I would hear people talk and I would sort of think and listen to my readers. And then I sort of took that big jump and thought, okay, I need to let go of that. I just let go of that and see what happens. And when I switched it to first person and started it much later and like just summarized all that, it felt like the novel like was a balloon tied to a piece of lead, you know? And then I just cut it and it just, whew, it just took off, you know? And I see that with the graduate students too, who I think are more, they're more professional and successful about it. Like if you give them feedback, they're pliable. You know what I mean? They sort of hear and think, okay, like I could do it this other way, or let me find a solution to that problem rather than just keep sticking band-aids on my original idea.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Sunlight Finds You?
Well, you know, it's always my first goal to just tell a good story, you know, like just no message, just here's a story. But it is interesting that Nora tells this story of her turbulent adolescence and early adulthood, you know, from the vantage point, she's decades older and she's looking back and she has, you know, she has regret. She has real regret, but she also, you know, she remembers the girl she was and why she did the things she did. And she's able to look back at herself, even her mistakes and also her good decisions, with a lot of compassion for herself. And so I think readers will naturally be sort of prompted to think of their own big decisions. You know, I have a friend right now, this friend is in her 70s and she's really been like going over her mistakes and just sort of like just really judging herself harshly for them. And I noticed that, you know, the compassion that Nora shows herself, I think that that is directly linked to the compassion she's able to show for the other people in her current life. And so I would hope that readers, you know, yeah, we can learn from the regret, but to also notice that, you know, if you can do that with self-compassion, that's better for everyone.
Well, the book is Sunlight Finds You. Laura Moriarty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth. It was always a pleasure to talk with you.
Sunlight Finds You by Laura Moriarty was published by Riverhead Books. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.